And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're also on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, August 31st, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are Don Winslow and Janelle Brown. First up is Don Winslow. He's a New York Times bestselling author who's written upwards of 20 novels, mostly thrillers and mysteries. He has an undergraduate degree in African studies and went on to get a master's degree in military history, intending to go into the Foreign Service, but instead joined a friend's photographic safari firm in Kenya. His first novel, A Cool Breeze on the Underground, was nominated for an Edgar Award, yet he continued to work as an investigator, and he and his wife and young son lived in hotels for 3 years as he worked cases and became a trial consultant and wrote. Then a film and a publishing deal for his novel, The Death and Life of Bobby Z, allowed Don Winslow to be a full-time writer. He's winner of the Raymond Chandler Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Ian Fleming Silver Dagger, and more. He lives here in California with his wife of 31 years, and his most recent novel is The Force, published by William Morrow. Hi, Don.
Hey, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you on.
Nice to be on. Thanks.
Well, let's begin with you taking us into The Force and talk a bit about how the novel came about.
You know, as a kid, I was really influenced by those kind of classic 1970s books and movies, The French Connection, Serpico, Prince of the City. They had a lot to do, really, with my becoming a crime writer in the first place. So I always kind of wanted to write a big New York cop novel in that genre, and I finally thought this was the time to do it.
Interesting. So the novel deals with themes of crime and injustice, loyalty and betrayal, and many more. And as I was reading, I was wondering if you think theme, as you set out to write, or is theme something readers apply to a work?
Is theme something readers apply to a work?
Yeah.
I don't think that readers go into a book, you know, looking for theme. And frankly, I don't know that I write a book starting with theme, you know. Where I really try to start is with character and characters. And then I try to see, you know, can we push those characters to the edge? Can we put them in a situation where they have difficult, if not impossible, choices to make? In this case, yeah, absolutely, it deals with loyalty versus betrayal, which is one of the fiercest dilemmas I think any of us can ever be in.
So Detective Sergeant Denny Malone is sort of the focus of the book, or the main character, and he is so compelling. He wants to be good. He takes care of his family. He takes care of his ex, but he gets caught up in a trap. And I was curious how much you knew about Malone going in.
I knew a lot, Barbara. You know, I've spent years and years talking with cops and about, you know, 5 years sort of interviewing people directly for this book, on and off. I always like to really know my characters well before I ever start writing. And in fact, typically, I won't start writing a book before the characters start talking to me, as airy-fairy as that sounds. When, you know, if I'm out taking a walk or something and all of a sudden the characters are sort of sprouting dialogue, that's when I think I'm ready to start writing the book.
So that goes on for a while, sounds like, before you actually start writing.
Can go on for years.
Really?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, no, I you know, sometimes you have an idea for a book, but that's all you have, or you have a character in mind. And I think it just takes time for that to develop. And you're also researching and you're learning more and more about that character's world, and then there comes a point where he does feel real and feels full, and you sort of know what he sees when he walks out the door in the morning, and what he likes to eat and what's on his mind and what music he listens to and all of that. And at that point, I think I'm ready to sit down and write the book. Before that, you know, maybe not so much.
So, and that happens with your secondary characters, too, because I found Claudette, Sheila, McGivern, Rousseau, they were all so detailed and individualistic. And so, you know, as I'm reading, I'm thinking, you know, how much could you possibly know about these people before you started writing? Because they just unfold and reveal themselves as you would, I suppose, someone you're getting to know.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, that's very nice of you to say, and I'm glad to hear that, because I think that, you know, we as people and certainly characters in fiction, you know, we don't exist alone. And I think that our friendships and relationships and our work relationships define us to a great extent. And so, yeah, I mean, I think a lot about those secondary characters. You know, in the case of the woman you mentioned, Claudette, I really wanted to have a woman that expands Malone's universe, that challenges him, that makes him think, that makes him see the world in a different way. And she seems to, you know, to fit that purpose.
Mm. Yeah, she's a great character. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Don Winslow. His new novel is The Force, published by William Morrow. This would be a great time to hear you read.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just start with page one.
Okay.
Okay. The last guy on Earth anyone ever expected to end up in the Metropolitan Correctional Center on Park Row was Denny Malone. You said the mayor, the president of the United States, the Pope, people in New York would have laid odds if they'd seen them behind bars before they'd see Detective First Grade Dennis John Malone, a hero cop, the son of a hero cop, a veteran sergeant in the NYPD's most elite unit, the Manhattan North Special Task Force. And most of all, a guy who knows where all the skeletons are hidden because he put half of them there himself. Malone and Rousseau and Billy O and Big Monty and the rest made these streets their own, and they ruled them like kings. They made them safe and kept them safe for the decent people trying to make lives there. And that was their job and their passion and their love. And if that meant they worked the corners of the plate and put a little something extra on the ball now and then that's what they did. The people, they don't know what it takes sometimes to keep them safe, and it's better that they don't. They may think they want to know. They may say they want to know, but they don't. Now Malone's in lockup. The wind has stopped blowing, but everyone knows it's the eye of the storm, the dead quiet lull that comes before the worst of it. Denny Malone in the hands of the feds, not IAB, not the state's attorneys, but the feds where no one in the city can touch him. Everyone's hunkered down and waiting for that blow, that tsunami, because with what Malone knows, he could take out commanders, chiefs, even the commissioner. He could roll on prosecutors, judges. He could serve the feds, the mayor, on the proverbial silver platter with at least one congressman and a couple of real estate billionaires as appetizers. Our ends know our beginnings, but the reverse isn't true. When Malone was a kid, the nuns taught him that even before we're born, God and only God knows the days of our lives and the day of our death and who and what we'll become. Well, I wish he'd shared it with me, Malone thinks, given me a word, a tip, dimed me out, ratted on me to myself, told me something, anything, said, hey, you took a left, you should have gone right. But no, nothing. All he's seen, Malone isn't a big fan of God and figures the feeling is mutual. He has a lot of questions you'd like to ask him, but if he ever got him in the room, God would probably shut his mouth, lawyer up, and let his own kid take the joke. All this time on the job, Malone lost his faith, so when the moment came when he was looking the devil in the eye, there was nothing between Malone and murder except 10 pounds of trigger pull, 10 pounds of gravity. It was Malone's finger on pulled the trigger, but maybe it was gravity that pulled him down, the relentless, unforgiving gravity of 18 years on the job, pulling him down to where he is now. He started with his eyes firmly on the guiding star, his feet planted on the path, but that's the thing about the life you walk. You start out pointed true north, but you vary 1 degree off. It doesn't matter for maybe 1 year, 5 years. But as the years stack up, you're just walking farther and farther away from where you started out to go. You don't even know you're lost until you're so far from your original destination you can't even see it anymore. You can't even get back on the path to start over. Time and gravity won't allow it. And Denny Malone would give a lot to start over. He'd give everything. Because he never thought he'd end up in the federal lockup on Park Row. No one did, except maybe God, and he wasn't talking. But here Malone is. Without his gun or his shield or anything else that says what and who he is, what and who he was, a dirty cop.
Thank you so much. That was Don Winslow reading from The Force, published by William Morrow. You know, I'm curious about the beginning chapters here, because this is the very first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have a prologue, and then you have a chapter one.
Yeah.
Or part one, chapter one. Talk about that.
Those were tough choices, you know, and I kept sort of moving the structure of that around. But I kind of discovered, you know, after finishing, I don't know, the first three or four drafts, I guess, that I didn't really want to write a what happened book as much as I wanted to write a how it happened mm-hmm. or why it happened book. And then I also thought, you know, if I start with Malone in this cage, you know, in deep trouble, and put the reader with him in there right away, then the reader was going to take that entire ride with him, already feeling that pressure. And I just thought that that was a better experience for the reader.
It's really interesting. And also the voice is really interesting, too. It's a third person, very close. And I'm new to your work. And now I'm intrigued to read more and see what else you do with voice and style. But talk about choosing the third person close.
Well, I love the third person close, and I love the present tense. I always think it's my job as a writer is to bring the reader into a world that he or she couldn't otherwise get into, or to see it in a different way. And in order to do that, I think that I need to see the world through the character's eyes. You know, I'm not trying to be objective. I'm always writing from a subjective place. And so that third person close, to me, is absolutely the best voice to do it. You know, you could do it in the first person, and that's a temptation sometimes, and of course that's the classic voice of noir fiction, is the first person. But the third person close allows me just that little bit more of flexibility than the first person does, where I can, you know, be in close with a character at the moment, seeing what they're seeing, but then also, if I choose to, I can step back just that little bit. Do you know what I mean? To see some things slightly from the outside. And I think those angles are what bring the reader closest to the character.
Yeah, I suppose in what you read, if that were first person, it would maybe some of your commentary about kind of life would maybe be more philosophizing as opposed to, I don't know, working in the narrative in a very nice way.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I mean, I have done some things in the first person. They're really fun in some ways, but very difficult in others. And, you know, you're always just trapped within that one character's point of view. Now, this is the only book I've ever written that's the third person close from just a single character.
Mm.
You know, we start with Denny and we stay with Denny. It never breaks. Most of my other books, I'll jump from character to character, you know, and see scenes through other characters' point of view. And that was a real challenge structurally in this book, because there would have been times just plot-wise where it would have been a lot easier to have switched to another character and gotten that scene through that character's point of view. But again, I wanted to bring the reader with Denny real tight, right from the worst part of his life, and keep them there, and keep them there together.
Do you think you'll do that again, just stay with one character?
Could be. I don't know. I mean, the book I'm working on right now, you know, is very big, complex, five or six major characters, and so it's certain that technique would not suit the book I'm working on now at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would do it again. You know, I sort of slipped into it with this book. And I really thought about it. There were times I thought, man, you know, it would be nice to see this scene through, you know, Claudette's point of view,
mm-hmm.
or through Russo, one of his, you know, partners' points of view. But I wrote several chapters that way, actually. But then I just found, no, it seems to be taking away from the intensity of the read. And so I, you know, hit the delete key.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The delete key is, you know, might be the most useful button on that keyboard.
So you know. Do you go straight to computer?
Well, most of the time. I usually write on a little Mac laptop. But sometimes I will write by hand on a yellow legal pad. It depends on the work I'm doing, you know. There are some times when I feel a real need to slow myself down. And so writing by hand on, you know, with a pen will do that.
Yeah.
I don't have a choice. It just does.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it makes the scene a little more contemplative and a little more lyrical. And then I can rewrite it when I'm typing it. But for the most part, no, I type directly on a computer.
Well, I was curious about that because, you know, you're almost 24 books in. And and I was curious how your process may have changed since you began.
You know, it's changed a lot, mostly because of business reasons. Let me explain that. You know, my first 6 books, I was still working other jobs. You know, I published 6 books, but they weren't enough to support me and my family. So I was doing other things, and so I was writing on whatever was available wherever I was, and I was traveling a lot. You know, I was doing cases in California. I was leading safaris in Kenya and hiking trips in China and directing Shakespeare in England and doing a variety of things. And so my goal in those days was page-driven. I said I was going to write 5 pages a day no matter what. And so that was at various times of the day, just depending on when I had that time, you know. After I was able to be a full-time writer, then I really switched the way that I work. So now I go to work at 5:30 in the morning, and I take a break to go walk or run or something mid to late morning, and then I work until 5:30 in the evening.
I read that. I read that somewhere, and you know, it's really a grueling schedule, isn't it?
Well, you know, it is. But you know, I mean, everyone works hard, don't they? You know, listen, this is the job I've wanted my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very grateful to have it. I feel very blessed that I'm able to do it. Therefore, I feel I need to treat it with respect, and treat it like the job I've always wanted. And for me, that means showing up. You know, I'm pretty much a blue collar guy, and you know, I've always believed you show up for work. But most of the world does that. You know, I get sometimes a little tired of writers kind of whining about it. You know? Oh, gosh, we work so hard and we get rejected. And, you know, everyone gets rejected. You know, everyone's, you know, wanted jobs they didn't get or, you know, assignments they didn't get or, you know. And I mean, I look out the window. I see, you know, most people working pretty hard. And I think I'm just one of them.
Well, in the early days then, when you were, you know, working jobs and writing books, how did you keep going? I mean, it you know, taking care of a family, having a kid, working a job, writing 5 pages a day, I mean, that's sort of a lot, and it wears on a lot of people trying to do that.
Yeah, it is a lot. Look, and it's hard to do, and sometimes what I tell, you know, aspiring writers in a similar situation is, you know, if you can write 5 pages a day, great. If you can write 1 page a day, great. You know, if you write 1 page a day, in about a year, you have a book.
Yeah.
If you can write a paragraph a day, great. But do it, you know. Just find those few moments. But you know what? I mean, we have one kid who's grown up now. I never took time away from him. I always felt that that was the most important thing, you know, and that if I wrote one less book over the course of my career because I've been out playing ball with my kid, you know, the world certainly wasn't going to suffer. But I would and he would.
Right.
And so I never closed the door, you know, ever. But, you know, it's really just sort of a matter of discipline and thinking, okay, you know, now you have some quiet time, and it might be early in the morning and it might be late at night. you know, sit down and do it, and don't whine about it, and consider yourself fortunate that you had the chance to do it.
Yeah. So you talked a few minutes ago about showing up, you know, just being there every day writing. And so will you leave off at a pivotal point in the story to pick up the next day, or do you know what's going to happen?
Most of the time I do. I follow that old Hemingway piece of advice, you know. It's one of the few Hemingway pieces of advice I would follow, you know. I try to do that. I try to leave off where I know what the next sentence is going to be so that I don't have that, you know, that white screen, blank screen time in the morning. Yeah, I try to do that. But sometimes I get carried away, you know. I just write my way all the way through it, you know. Leave myself in trouble the next morning.
Well, we have a few minutes left, and I wish we had more time. So one thing I do want to ask you about, though, is something I read about maybe in the Globe and Mail, where you praised the writing of Raymond Chandler, and this book has an epigraph by Raymond Chandler.
Right.
And so I'm curious how much of an influence he was, and if you have a favorite Chandler novel.
I do. I do. I think, and Michael Connelly and I, by the way, share this opinion. We think that The Long Goodbye is the greatest P.I. novel ever written, and maybe one of the best novels ever written. You know, look, Chandler was the grandfather of us all, and, you know, we all owe him our livings. And, you know, when I read Chandler, it can be both inspiring and depressing. You know, inspiring because it's so great and so beautiful, and depressing because you know if you write for the next 100 years, you're not going to write anything half that good, you know. So I go back and read Chandler frequently, and, you know, I'm always blown away by it.
Well, Don, it's been a great pleasure to have you on. And as I said, I wish we had more time.
Yeah, me too. This has been fun. I hope to do it again.
I hope you come back.
I will, absolutely. Just call me.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That was Don Winslow. His book is The Force, published by William Morrow. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we should have Janelle Brown with us. Don't go away.
Non so cosa sia la fedeltà, la ragione del mio canto, che resistere non può ad un così dolce pianto. Mutò l'amore mio, e se anche il sorgere del sole ci trovasse ancora insieme, per favore dimmi no, rende stupidi anche i saggi l'amore, amore mio. Oh, l'immagine di te. Così persa nei miei occhi, mi portò la verità. Ama quello che non ha l'amore, amore mio. Se dentro l'anima tu fossi musica,
welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and the first half I was here with Dawn Winslow, and I'm back with Janelle Brown. Before we bring her on, I just need to tell you a few things. One is that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of me and my guests. And the other thing I want to tell you is to check out my website, penonfire.com. Janelle Brown, who's about to come on with us, will be at the Pen on Fire Speaker Series September 12th. And you can find out more about that at the website, on the website. I know there's more. Oh, wait. Ladies of Intrigue is coming up October 1st. It's a all-day conference with panels and such of mystery authors at the Doubletree in Irvine. And you can find out more about that by going to mysteryinc.com. And there you can see who's going to be there, and you can register, and all sorts of great things. Janelle Brown is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels All We Ever Wanted Was Everything and This Is Where We Live. Her journalism and essays have appeared in the New York Times, Vogue, Elle, Wired, Self, and the Los Angeles Times. She's worked as a senior writer at Salon and began her career as a staff writer at Wired during the dot-com boom years, working on seminal websites like Hotwired and Wired News. She's a native of San Francisco and a graduate of UC Berkeley. She now lives in L.A. with her family. Her new novel is Watch Me Disappear, which is the focus of our talk today. Hi, Janelle.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, great to have you on. We just scheduled you a few days ago, and that's when I jumped into the novel. And I've not been able to put it down. I'm almost finished, and I love it. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about how Watch Me Disappear came about.
Okay. Well, you know, Watch Me Disappear was a very long and circuitous, had very long and circuitous genesis, really. You know, I finished my last book. I published my last book 7 years ago and had two kids in quick succession. So when I kind of sat down to start working on this book 5 years ago, I was imagining the book originally as kind of a meditation on grief and memory, you know, about the loss of a mother, a father and a daughter having lost a mother in a tragic accident, and kind of following them as they try and recover. And as I wrote the book, I realized that I was starting to write a mystery, which I hadn't really intended to do. But, you know, 100 pages in, I realized I'm doing something I didn't really plan, and I really like it. So I had to go back and rethink the whole book that I had originally been writing and rewrite it with with a new end in mind and a new goal in mind, to make it more of a suspense.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. I was curious how much you knew about the ending going in, and I haven't gotten there yet. So I, you know, I'm thinking a few different things could happen. We'll see, right? But how much did you know about the ending going in then?
I, without giving away the ending, I actually originally imagined an ending. And when I sold the book to my editor based on the first half, I'd written the first half and I had an outline of the second half. And she loved the first half that I'd written and was reading the outline of the second half and said, I love the book. I don't love the ending. I think you can do better. And so I had to go and do a whole rethink of where the book was going and what it was going to be based on a new ending. And so I wrote the book to that ending and then again showed it to my editor. She's like, I still don't think it's right. And threw that ending away. I wrote a whole new ending, which once I wrote it, I'm like, oh, yes, of course, this is where I should have been going in the first place. But I had to, you know, of course, go back and read. You can't just tack a new ending onto a book like this. You have to rethink the whole book. So there was a lot of reengineering.
So, okay, so you rewrote, you threw away what you originally had because it was becoming a mystery or suspense novel, and then you wrote the first half and you outlined the second half and then later reconfigured the ending and had to go back in and mm-hmm. kind of work the book to have mm-hmm. it match the ending, sounds like.
Yeah, basically.
So are you typically a plotter?
No. I mean, I am in the sense that, of course, I always, you know, I imagine where the story is going to go and I'll make outlines and come up with ideas. But I am not the person who sits there with note cards and elaborate outlines. My outlines are fairly minimal, in part because I have always found that no matter how much I plot and plan, when I start writing, the characters, as they come to life, start informing the story in ways that I, you know, couldn't have predicted. You know, character is story, right? Action comes from character. People do things because that's innate to the type of people that they are. And it's kind of hard to know that before you've started writing the people. You can imagine a character, but once they come to life in the page, they often go in directions just can't imagine. And so I'll be writing a book and I will find the book going in a whole, taking a left turn towards some place I had never thought before because it feels like something that the character would do. It feels more true to the character than what I might originally have imagined.
Mm. Was the structure there from the start of the recast of the book? I mean, I love how you have, you know, two points of view, at least to the point where I'm at, Jonathan and Olive. And I love how Jonathan's excerpts from Jonathan's forthcoming memoir about his missing wife, which we find out very close to the start, so that's not really a spoiler. But I love how you, you know, intersperse those sections with then, and so those are in the first person, and then they're usually followed, if not always followed, by a third person chapter with Jonathan's point of view. And then we go back into Olive and it kind of rotates around. And I wonder when you came up with that structure and why you decided on it.
Well, to back up a little bit, I'm writing a book about a woman who's missing, right? You know, the mother, Billy, goes for a hike in the woods, and body never comes back. Body is never found, and it's about her daughter and her husband, you know, trying to cope with her loss, but then also starting to wonder who she really was, whether she was alive, and you know, or if, whether she really died at all, whether she might still be alive, and you know, who, what are the secrets that she had, right? So I was trying to build. You know, I realized as I was writing this book that I was. There's a big hole at the center of the book, and there's a character, you know, one of the main characters isn't on the page. She's not there. She's gone. So how do you bring somebody to life who you can't put them in the room with the rest of your characters because they're missing. So, you know, I toyed with a lot of different ideas as I was writing it. The third person, Olive and Jonathan chapters came very naturally. That just felt like what I wanted to do, alternate the points of view. But trying to figure out how to get Billy alive, I started to realize that, you know, I could either do flashbacks, which, you know, is a trope a lot of authors use, and it can be effective. And I do use that in moments, you know, memories. But I really liked the idea of creating this memoir motif. So basically the idea is that Jonathan, his wife's dead, he thinks, and so he's writing this kind of loving memoir about her. And so what I liked about that is you could both see his memories of her through his first-person lens, and then also, over the course of the book, realize that that lens is very subjective, that he's been remembering her selectively, remembering the best parts of her. And so as the book goes on, you can, you know, the tone of the memoir starts to shift as he starts learning these things about his wife that make him rethink who she really was and remember, forcing him to remember the things that he didn't maybe love about her so much. So it worked really well for me in two ways, both bringing in the memories of Billy so you could bring her to life on the page, but also allowing the theme to come through about, you know, the subjectivity of memory and how we tell stories about people that we love in order to kind of make them fit the narrative that we want to have about who they are. Does that make sense?
Yep. It sure does. Well, this would be a great time to hear you read from Watch Me Disappear.
Oh, sure, sure. I did not realize I was going to read. I forgot to do that. I'm going to have a section of about, in fact, I'll read a section from the memoir right now. Let's see. I completely blanked on this part of it. One second while I find it. So I'm going to read a section that's actually from the memoir, which is, again, Jonathan's point of view. He's remembering things about his life. And this actually section is about his sister and the death of his sister.
Okay.
This is about three pages. Lenny was the one who suggested we sneak into the neighbor's pool. It was an oppressive summer day, heavy with Midwestern humidity, and our own shrubby backyard provided no relief from the sun. Our mother had forbidden us to leave the house while she was off doing the shopping. Jenny was 10, I was 8, and we were only just allowed to stay at home alone. After a half hour of playing listlessly with our Atari, my sister suddenly lifted her head. "Let's go swimming," she said. "Now? Where?" I asked. "The Wilsons." She was already standing at the window on her tiptoes, peering out over the hedge into the yard of our neighbors, whose crystalline blue pool had remained woefully unused all summer. "They're both at work. They'll never know." My sister had always been the scrappy one, her knees scabby from her skateboard, and her report card filled with admonishments from her teachers, whereas I was the good kid, bookish, rule-bound, depressingly beautiful. "I'm glad you know better than that," my mother would whisper to me when my sister came home with yet another bloody nose from a fight at school. But sitting in my room with only books and my Star Wars action figures for company, I wasn't sure that was really true. Jenny always seemed to be deeply immersed in life, whereas I was skating along the edge, dipping my toe in. So that day, I followed her into the Wilson's yard, clambering over the ornamental hedge, which scraped our shins raw. We left our shorts on the lounge chairs and danced across the hot concrete, jumping into the water in our underwear and T-shirts. The water so cold that it felt like a slap, leaving us breathless and laughing, the sun beating down mercilessly on our faces when we burst up through the surface. It was one of those moments when you know what it really means to be alive, to have every cell in your body attuned to the astonishing fact of your existence. "This is amazing," I called to my sister. "Hell yeah," Jenny replied. I'll always remember my sister, the way she looked as she climbed out of the pool, her cropped blonde hair, a shiny cap against her head, the soaked T-shirt clinging to the boyish planes of her chest, her face shining with happiness. He walked back toward the hedge, crouched down like a sprinter. "Double backflip," she announced, and then broke into a run, her knees flying. She was on the steaming concrete, and then her toes were gripping the tile edge of the pool, and then she was impossibly high in the air, and then she was deep under the water, and she wasn't coming up. Or rather, she was coming up, but in a very strange way, upside down, her legs floppy, her short hair drifting aimlessly around her head. "Dead man's float," I told myself, waiting for her to stop joking around, and yet something looked wrong. "Stop it," I said out loud from where I sat frozen on the steps of the pool. "Stop it, Jenny, stop it." I kept saying this to myself over and over, as if when I'd said it enough times, Jenny would finally roll over and laugh at me. Even once I knew for sure that something was terribly, terribly wrong, I still sat there paralyzed, thinking, "I have to call 911. No, I have to swim in and rescue her. I'll do the Heimlich. No, CPR. Which one is it? I don't know how anyway. I have to call Dad at the office. He'll know what to do. No, he'll know we broke into the neighbors and we'll get in trouble. No, that doesn't matter." It was probably only a matter of seconds, and yet it felt like an eternity had passed before I thrashed my way into the water, spluttering through my tears, and tugged my sister's horrifyingly leaden body to the steps, propping her there half out of the water. I whacked at her back with the flat of my hand, tried to breathe into her lungs, but her empty eyes told me that it was already too late. And yet I kept shouting, "Stop it, Jenny, stop it," as I scrambled back over the hedge, getting a nasty gash on my thigh that would go unnoticed in the days to come and would ultimately fester before it was treated, leaving a faint scar that I can't bear to look at even as an adult. No one blamed me, no one except myself. "Your sister was older. She was the one in charge," my father said as he sat on the edge of my bed, his red eyes the only clue to his own swallowed grief. "Even if you had known CPR, it wouldn't have helped. She broke her neck. The doctor said it was instantaneous." But I knew he was wrong. I knew that those crucial seconds when I thought the useless had to mean something. And even earlier than that, I was supposed to be the smart one, the responsible one. I should have cut Jenny off when she came up with the idea in the first place. I knew better than that. In the years that followed, I tried to make up for the death of my sister by being even better behaved, as if doubling my achievements might somehow mask the loss of an entire child. I learned how to be charming and funny so I could make my parents smile again. I became editor of my high school newspaper, graduated at the top of my class, went to Stanford, got a job in Silicon Valley, dated a string of nice girls with admirable resumes. "He must be a real consolation to them," I could hear the neighbors whisper, but I secretly knew that it was no consolation at all. So was it any surprise when, at age 26, I met a woman who reminded me of my dead older sister, all grown up, living on the sharp edge of convention, self-assured down to the bone, that I would thrill to her, that I would leap to make up for all my past failings, to protect her, sacrifice myself to her, and think that by doing so, I was somehow being noble? Maybe it was inevitable that I would fall for Billy. Maybe it was inevitable that I would willfully ignore all her faults. Only someone fearful of his own ordinariness would buy so unquestioningly someone else's extraordinariness. Maybe this is why they say love is blind. Who you want people to be makes you blind to who they really are.
Thank you so much. That was Janelle Brown reading from Watch Me Disappear, published by Spiegel & Grau. So this section comes maybe midway in the book. And
yeah.
And did you know that this is what happened to Jenny before you got here?
When I started the book, I didn't. But I was, you know, working on the characters of Jonathan and Billy, and the more I got to know them as characters, the more I realized that I needed to understand more about why Jonathan was, you know, so willfully blind in a lot of ways to this very complicated woman that he was married to, a woman who kind of this uber mom character, and she's very, you know, Berkeley, chia seed muffin baking, you know, party throwing, but also has this really kind of complex hidden past and a lot of, you know, complicated parts of her character that he has been kind of glossing over in his you know, in his relationship with her, and especially after her death, he's kind of ignoring these parts. So I had to really think about, you know, what would make someone be like that? You know, what causes that? And so I started kind of thinking back to his childhood and imagining his childhood, and I came up with this kind of tragic moment from his childhood that has really informed his character. So that came about, I don't know, maybe halfway through the writing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. It came at the perfect place for me in the book. So Harmony is an interesting character, and as the story goes on, she appears to not be as innocent as she first seems to be. I'm so curious how she's going to figure in with the ending of the book. How much did you know about Harmony going in?
She's one of those characters that really kind of came to me pretty much right away. I really loved the idea of this, you know, Berkeley type, the super crunchy, you know, emotionally attuned, you know, out there doing her meditation and are getting centered, and yet who's completely not. And you realize that increasingly as the book goes on. I really liked her as kind of a foil to Billy, and she, a foil and really ultimately a frenemy for Billy. Like, they're best friends, but they kind of hate each other, and they're absolutely opposite in all ways, and yet they keep each other close. I knew that she needed to be there from the very beginning of the book. Like, she was one of the very first characters that came to me outside of Jonathan, Billy, and Olive.
Yeah. I think after the show, I'm going to have to finish this book because I need to know what happens. I just love it. Earlier you mentioned, you know, sending a draft to your editor, and the editor's like, well, the ending's not right. And then again, the ending's still not right. So how, as a writer then, do you know what to pay attention to with an agent or an editor? And are there times when you say, no, this just has to stay?
Yeah, I have. I have definitely, you know, I find like when I get notes and I'll absorb all the notes and I'll think about them. And so there'll be things that I kind of toss aside, but the big ones I'll really cogitate on and let them sit. And sometimes I've had moments when I've gotten a note and I've been like, no, I don't think that's right. But the big ones that I get that I agree with, I won't necessarily take it in the exact suggestion that my editor might have thought, but I'll use the general suggestion and make it my own, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So at what point do you share your work with readers, with other writers?
I know, as early as I can. I used to have a really great writers group, and we would meet weekly and we read all of each other's work, and that's how I wrote my first two novels. And then we all had kids, and it got really hard to meet on a weekly basis. But we're all friends still, and we will read each other's work on command, and convene for, you know, hey, I really need to read. Can we get together? And, you know, we might have not seen each other in 6 months, but we'll get together and help each other out. And I find that feedback invaluable. I think 100 pages probably is about where I would start wanting to get real feedback from someone, because that's when you've got enough on the page to know where you're going and what you need to do, and to also have the first eyes on it to kind of give it a shape of where it's going to go next.
Yeah. Well, speaking of having small children, what's your discipline with actually being able to get writing done?
Well, my kids are in school, thank God. my one child's in kindergarten, the other one's in second grade. And so it's gotten progressively easier as they've gone up in school. And I basically drop them at school, go to my office, and work until pick up, which, you know, it's mid to late afternoon.
Office in your house, outside of your house?
I actually have, I helped found a collective writer space in Silver Lake in Los Angeles where I live, and we have about 25 writers in a group office that we, it's kind of like a little community, communal workspace.
Nice. I think I read about it, actually. I must have read about it in the LA Times or something.
There's an LA Times story, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We're called Sweet Eight.
That's nice. That's nice. That's great.
It's great. It's great. It's wonderful to have it to me. I'm not, you know, I work at home sometimes, but I feel like writing is such a solitary thing to do anyway. Like, I don't want to be just so cut off from the world. I get more inspired by being out there and having action and people around me. Yeah. So
in closing, and I get to talk with you more in September when you're down here at the speaker series, but just in closing, can you name a couple of books, a couple of novels that have been influential in your own sort of development as a writer, or maybe novels you reread every now and then because of whatever, the writing, the story, just how they make you feel?
Yeah, absolutely. For this one, I read a lot of Megan Abbott. There's a book called The Fever that she wrote that I loved. Ton of French, The Secret Place was another one that I read a lot when I was working in this, and Gone Girl, of course, because those books are so masterful in storytelling. And then other authors that I've read, I read their books over and over again. Jennifer Egan, I think The Visit from the Goon Squad is just such a masterpiece. Jonathan Franzen, The Corrections, was a big influence on my first book, and I still think he's a terrific author. Tom Perrotta is a big influence, too.
Janelle, thank you so much for coming on the show at such short notice. And I can't wait to talk more when you come down.
My pleasure. I'm so glad I could do this. And
thanks.
I look forward to talking more, too.
All righty. That was Janelle Brown. Her book is Watch Me Disappear, published by Spiegel & Grau. It's a great read. As I said, I need to finish this today because I need to know what happens. And that's why we read, right? We need to know what happens. I'm going to leave you now. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. You writers out there, stay in the chair.